It has been a long time since I was out fishing. I grew up in southern Ontario, and for part of my life, I was born in Toronto, in Scarborough, and you have very kindly accepted me nonetheless. But we did move out to the countryside, and we had a river in our backyard. We could canoe on it and catch walleye and fry them up. It was really nice. My father taught me to clean and to gut the fish. Now, I don't have a memory of doing that too often. And I think I left that and all of to do with slimy fish behind when I left home. I don't think I've been fishing once since then. But maybe some of you have fished, and maybe some of you even enjoy it. And you know what I mean by gutting a fish, where you start at the back and you make a little incision and carry along the belly, and then most of the organs carefully have to be brought out, and then you wash it out. At that point, you can fry it up as it is. And I admit it, it's tasty. That's what it means to gut a fish. We can also use the word gutting in terms of our homes. If you buy a home and you need to renovate and it's maybe in a really bad shape, you talk about gutting your home. And you mean really just stripping it down, everything down to the bare bones, the studs. You may even mean ripping out the plumbing and the electrical. You're gutting the house. And we carry over that metaphor into our own bodies when we talk about our emotions. When we meet something, when something happens to somebody else that we care about deeply, we use that expression, I'm gutted. I heard what happened to you, and I'm gutted. And we're trying to get at that feeling that you get in the knot of your stomach and somewhere deep in the midst of you, you're just churning up for them. Sometimes we get so upset that we're physically sick. We're gutted. In Greek, there is a similar idea, this connection between our compassion and our guts. And the word is this very memorable and almost impossible to pronounce in English word, splagna. It means the guts, the bowels. When it's used as a verb, splagnitsomai, it's used in an active tense, it's used in sacrifices. Do you get the picture of what's happening in the sacrifice? It's pretty gruesome. When it's used most of the time in the New Testament, though, it means that gut-level feeling of compassion, where you just are almost eviscerated. You feel churned up. You are gutted for somebody. This is what the Samaritan felt when he was walking down the road and he saw somebody who'd been beaten and abandoned. He was gutted. I believe Jesus' main goal here, or main lesson, is not to convince us to help people. I don't think Jesus' main point is that we should help people in need. I think Jesus' main point is to make us into compassionate people, people who, when they see others, are moved out of a sense deep in their guts of loving every person they meet and having mercy on every person they meet. Did you notice at the end of the parable how Jesus changed the question? What was the question the lawyer asked? Who is my neighbor? Jesus had said, or the law says, love your neighbor as yourself. And the lawyer said, well, who is my neighbor? What is the question that Jesus, how is it that Jesus phrases the question? It is no longer who is my neighbor. It is who was a neighbor? The question has changed from doing to being. If we ask the question, who is my neighbor? The question is, well, which person am I supposed to help? On which occasion am I supposed to intervene and do something? Could you clarify the circumstances? What kind of a person? When? When am I supposed to do this? But Jesus puts the emphasis on you. Who was a neighbor? Who are you? All the time. The lawyer's response confirms that this is what Jesus was saying. The lawyer heard this clearly. The lawyer understands that Jesus is interested in transforming not just our individual actions and our behavior on occasions, but Jesus is trying to transform our hearts. Because the lawyer doesn't respond with, "My neighbor is anyone I meet who is in need." What does the lawyer say? The one who had compassion. That is the one I am supposed to be. I am supposed to be the one who had compassion. Now, it's not a big difference, maybe you'll say. Maybe I'm just making a big deal out of a few little changes of words. The point clearly is to go out and help people, right? Yes. I'm not arguing with that. But the difference is there all the same. And perhaps we don't want to see it. It's much easier just to have a list of circumstances when I will help, as opposed to being told, go out and be the kind of person who has compassion on everyone. The impulse to help is no longer to come from external circumstances. The impulse to help is meant to come from deep within us, in our bowels, to be compassionate people and merciful. Now, there are two dangers in our acts of compassion today and the way the things we're confronted with. First, there's a danger from institutionalized compassion. I mean the huge Western government-run compassionate programs that I am thankful to God for that we have, and I live in a country that supports these things. I don't feel bad at all about my taxes going toward supporting hospitals that are fair for everyone, and schools for everyone, and social welfare, and public pensions, things that have a connection to this very church through, how can I forget? Tommy Douglas, who helped champion them and get them brought about in Saskatchewan, and once that domino became a domino that led to all the other provinces in our country adopting them. Tommy Douglas attended this church as he entered politics after retiring as our sister church in Weyburn, and would sit right up there in this pews, I've been told many times. We have pictures of him teaching the kids. I am grateful that we have these programs, and I'm grateful for all of the private charities that are, especially in Saskatchewan, we continue to support through our giving, shelters and soup kitchens and help for newcomers to Canada. All these programs arguably exist thanks to Jesus changing human hearts 2,000 years ago, and the Christian compassion that was passed on heart to heart and home to home. As Christians entered government, increasingly they changed the laws of the lands and looked to make these sort of individual practices part of just the way all of society functioned. And so we end up where we are today, with the government acting on our behalf to efficiently and effectively make sure that everybody has these services available to them. I'm not have a problem with that. I have a problem with the impact that organized charity has on the Samaritan. In this story, the Samaritan had to choose to practice compassion. When large institutions do that for the Samaritan, the danger is that Samaritan is going to walk down the road and see a person in need and say, "Well, thank goodness that my taxes go towards health care and that I give towards Souls Harbor. That person is taken care of," and they're just going to keep on walking on their way. They will miss out the chance to develop compassion and to act on compassion that arises in their very guts. These institutions can have the opposite effect of what we set out to do, because compassion slowly drains away. When it's sort of an organization that's taking care of it, nobody has to enter into this practice out of compassion. We have experienced this. Many of you have. There are nurses who head into nursing, and it's in their guts that they will love the person and do everything they can to take care of the person in the bed in front of them. They see them as who they are. They imagine them outside of this circumstance as someone who was once young and alive, who did all sorts of incredible things, and they treat the person with compassion. They're moved with compassion. But we also have people who enter into nursing out of need for a job. And it is just a rote practices that they are moving through. And we know how it feels to be treated that way, whether it's by a doctor or a teacher or by someone who is helping to you in social services, whether it's someone who's helping you in the government with your taxes, whatever it is. We know the difference between somebody who enters into the job out of a desire to help because of their deep felt compassion. The greater danger is that the more people move into these jobs without having that sense of compassion, that the ends justify terrible means. We have these lofty goals: end poverty, end hunger, end homelessness. But there is a danger that those ends can be used to justify increasingly radical means. We need a final solution to this problem, even if it means sending in the police to take the children and force them to do something. We will make this work. And then the children are sent to places where people are treating it as a rote and not being moved out of compassion for them. And hundreds of children are abused. I struggle with this all the time. I mean, I walk the path of the Samaritan over again in my neighborhood. And I see someone in need, and I have compassion on them. Yes, Steve, what do you need? Let me feed you. I've got some food. Let me get you a place to stay. And I feel great seeing him taken care of. Next week, I'm walking past again. Steve, what the heck happened? You got beat up again? Here you are at the side of the road again? Okay, we'll help you. And the next week, and the week after. And you want to say, look, buddy, take a different road. I mean, why do you keep coming down this road? Why do you keep coming alone? You keep ending up in the same situation. Do something different. Now, with a compassionate heart, I ask myself, even if my problem is not the same as Steve's, is it so easy for me to change? Oh, maybe my problems aren't leading me to end up on the side of the road in the ditch. But my problems are there. And it's really been hard for me to change. I keep returning, like in the words of this Proverbs and Peter, like a dog to my own vomit. How easy has it been for you to change how you speak and how you think and how you behave? Would others say that you've made a lot of progress over the years? I think it's hard for all of us to change. I'm left with a tension. I find it incredibly frustrating, and I want to force the one in need to get the help they need and to make the choices they need to make. But I know that that path just doesn't usually lead to good outcomes. As you know, every Saturday we open our doors. And anybody who wants a free bag lunch is welcome to come to take as much as they need. The people who come are hungry, and we knew that there were few resources available to people on Saturdays. And so we created this partnership with over 20 other churches that have taken part over the last 3 years. We've created this to meet a need. The danger is that we could find ourselves down there handing out a lunch without compassion. You have a problem, I have fixed it. Done. But I am convinced that the most important moment in that whole Saturday morning is the moment when somebody looks the other person in the eye and has the opportunity to feel compassion for them. For every chance that there is to learn the other person's name, to learn something about them, and to make a human-to-human contact with them, to be moved by what they are going through. Who is my neighbor? Well, for most of human history, this has been a really important question. Your village, your family, your clan, your tribe, my people. These are the people that I help first, and I look after their well-being first. There's a line around that group. Now, Jesus didn't dissolve that line and that bond. He wasn't saying, that doesn't matter. Instead, he expanded it, and he deepened it. You know how to care for the people that are your blood, but I want you to have that same compassion for everyone that you meet. I want you to be people of compassion. I want to move from an external commitment to people that you can identify, made in certain moments, to a disposition that you hold towards everyone. Jesus' words for us do not remove our call to have compassion for our literal neighbor. Jesus isn't saying that your literal neighbor isn't the one I'm thinking about, it's other people that you meet in need. He's starting with the person who lives next door to you and moving out from there. Last week we asked the question, Jesus asked us the question, do you see this woman? If we were to apply that to today, it would be, do you know the person living next door to you? Do you know their names? Do you know their names two doors down? Or three? Just how far could we go before you didn't know anyone around you? We scratch our heads at why there is an epidemic of loneliness. And yet when I've heard pastors talk about this, mean and snarky person that I am, I went to a seminar and someone was talking about loving your neighbor and community. And I said, at the end, I said, where do you live? In an apartment building. And I said, do you know the people living next door to you? And they went, oh, no. When you're in the elevator, do you broach that contract that we have with one another? Don't make eye contact. Or do you say, hi? Yes, I am the weird, smiley, friendly guy. That's what my wife calls me. You're the one that, you know, there's crazy people downtown, and you're one of them. People say to each other, you know that weird, smiley guy that walks around down saying hi to everybody? We should make an effort to know our next-door neighbors. And we should make an effort to see the people around us and to practice compassion. There is a second danger that is becoming very apparent, maybe, to all of us over the last few weeks. What on earth are we to do as Canadians if our relationship with the government of the United States of America continues to deteriorate? Are we to treat them as enemies? Are we to be even actively or quietly satisfied when we hear the anthem booed? Are we allowed to hate Canadians who would prefer to join the United States of America? Jesus' teaching to love your enemy and to have compassion for everyone is a threat to all social order. If enemies start having compassion on each other, how is the community, that boundaried group, how is it to defend itself? If people from within that group start having compassion on enemies, won't that leave all of us vulnerable? If we stop acting on what's best for us within these boundaries, aren't we going to lose out to others who are only too happy to take advantage of us because we only think of ourselves? They only think of themselves? Dare I say this, if as Canadians we refuse to buy Canadian out of compassion for our American neighbors, what on earth will happen to Canada? Now, we're not all of one mind in this congregation, and I'm doing my best not to take sides, as it were. I will say, but that the way that the United States government right now is talking about tariffs and talking openly about invading Canada and Gaza and Greenland, the way they are talking about it is going to stir up intense passions on all sides of the border. And passions that are stirred up that can't easily be controlled. Passions that could lead to things that it becomes this, you know, landslide, this domino effect where our, the next generation inherits something very different than what we were given in our relationship with our neighbors to the south. If this sort of talk continues, it's going to be even harder, as hard as it has been over the last few years, it's going to be even harder to talk and disagree with one another over politics. Will you be able to have compassion on someone who advocates for Canada becoming part of the United States? From the other side, will you have compassion on people as they criticize the American president? If you feel that he's being treated unfairly, that his words and his actions are being twisted, will you be able to have compassion on your fellow Canadians? Let's keep in mind that the Samaritans and the Jews were enmeshed in deep, centuries-long conflict. Sometimes open war and murder and theft. There was deep, deep resentment. They were enemies. And there was firm lines around these communities. People have observed, the lawyer isn't even able to say the name Samaritan, but the one. Can't even bring himself to say these words. Think of the disciples going through Samaria. Jesus, can we call down fire on the Samaritans? Does compassion on your enemies work? Repeatedly people say, that's not the real world. But this is why it is so crucial for us to practice it. Right now, we can see that maybe things could get ugly. Well, let's practice compassion and forgiveness and mercy now when it's not so hard. The day could come when there are real lines in the sand drawn. And it's not going to be easy to know what to do. It's not going to be clear. So let us become the kind of people for whom compassion, mercy for our enemies, is instinctive and something that is just resides deeply within us like our intestines, our bowels. Jesus asks us to be gutted for our enemies and for everyone we meet. And Jesus modeled it. In Paul's own words, while we were still enemies, Jesus was crucified for us. He surrendered his life so that we could live. And he says to us, if you would follow me, take up your cross. It is easy to think of seeing someone in need and helping. But Jesus is asking something far harder from us. Something far more radical that it will take all of our lives to resolve. And there may be some very complex situations where we can't really figure out or agree what it is we're supposed to do. But Jesus makes it clear that what he wants for us is a new heart, one that is filled with compassion. Who was a neighbor? The one who had compassion. Go and do likewise to the glory of God. Amen.